My name is Leo. My last name is very difficult because very few people can pronounce it. I really prefer Houston, but I won't be offended if you call me Bumston or Busted. It is really a proper noun. This is my ninth trip to Holden, so I've become very fond of it. And I think I'm living proof that if you come here often enough, they'll put you on the staff to give a few lectures. I don't mean that to be a threat to anyone. I hope that during this our stay here and our visit together, and as a result of our meeting together, that life will become more meaningful and more significant to us. My hope and prayer is that someone may receive a new insight into life, new life, which is our theme for this year, I think. For me, it is often that in individual confrontation that a wisp of insight here or a shaft of light there, sometimes slowly and sometimes suddenly, remake one in one's world. I think it is a truth that the life is changed, the world is changed. Now, the historian Toynbee once said that the three greatest hazards to our civilization are war and nuclear war, racism, and alcoholism. I will be discussing these subjects today, or starting today, and in the few weeks ahead, not only these three subjects, and I'll have some help on some of them. I already have one volunteer on alcoholism. next Friday, I'll be discussing the art of listening. I'm no authority on listening, although I've listened to probably as many lectures as anybody my age, and probably more than most. And I've probably heard only about or understood or retained less than 25% of it, just like everybody else does. And this has disturbed me because it is only recently that I've joined the professorial ranks of the University of California. And although I've done teaching before, I'm always disturbed by what the students, and these are quite outstanding students, write down in their examinations. And I'm disturbed by the people in my laboratory to whom I give instructions, and they don't really follow them. And then the problem at home, which we all have, we do leave instructions that are not followed for varying reasons. And some of it is, I think, that they really do not know how to listen. So on Friday, I'm going to talk about noises and voices. And some of the research that's done on noise today. And then something on the art of listening, a la sort of Nichols at Minnesota, who is really studying this. And it's, I think it'll be an interesting adventure. At least it's been interesting for me to sort of go through it. And it may be helpful to the professors to maybe offer me some suggestions too to improve this business of empathy or something. Some other subjects that I will be discussing, and most of these are on the basis of my experiences, because I live in a world of or I've lived in a world of animals. I've spent most of my life observing animals, and they me. And so most of my discussions will be related to these experiences, and I'll be pointing out what laboratory animals do teach us about these things. And in that context, then I will be discussing cancer, aging, death. I do also talk about people. Some especially on population control. Overpopulation is a much discussed subject today, and it's going to be kind of a free-for-all, because I think my views are somewhat different than Carol Hinderly's, and I want to be sure that he's in camp that day. He told me that he's going to be here in July, so we're going to have a great time on the subject of overpopulation. On Friday night, we're going to have a free-for-all on the revolt at the camp and the campuses. And we'll start out with Berkeley, I guess. It's a good place to start, as long as we don't finish up there. On a couple of evenings, there's been a request that I repeat my talk on my life with the pigs. I have spent much of my life with the pigs, and probably can figure that out. And that's the reason that quite a few people laugh here when people do mention pigs, because I say pigs are like people. I used to say people were like pigs, but that was not as popular. When I finish up with you, you will have the feeling that when you are called a pig, it will be a compliment. I may also, if the film gets here, to discuss with you monkey business, and that has to do with the extensive work being done today on subhuman primates in research. I'm a consultant of one of the primate centers, and I'm on the campus where another one is, and it might be interesting for you to see what's going on there. And then I have a couple of readings that we may do as soon as my daughter finishes the illustrations for Lafcadio, the lion who shot back. It's a comic thing until you start thinking about it. So now I've delayed long enough, and we'll come to the subject of a nuclear war. But as was my pattern last summer, I usually begin my lectures with readings from George MacDonald, from C.S. Lewis's anthology of George MacDonald. And this was given to me, in fact, by Al Rognes, who is also a fan of George MacDonald and C.S. Lewis. And he's very contemporary, although he wrote this in the 1800s. And he has, I think, something to say about our subject today. First one is fear. Until a man has love, it is well that he should have fear. So long as there are wild beasts about, it is better to be afraid than secure. And the other one is the mystery of evil. The darkness knows neither the light nor itself. Only the light knows itself, and the darkness also. None but God hates evil and understands it. Now, I have structured this lecture, and I can be interrupted. I can depart from an unprepared text to answer questions at any time. But I structured it sort of like this on a nuclear war. Carol Hinderly is very sleepy in the morning, and when I gave my announcement to him this morning, he only read part of it. And the reason that I missed the part of Walt's lecture this morning is that I sort of changed my mind, and I decided to dwell on nuclear war rather than radiation effects today. And I think it would be better to discuss radiation effects with illustrations maybe some evening, and we get around to it. Now, and I'm going to talk about some of the dimensions and scope. Now you say, well, that's sort of the same thing. But nuclear war is sort of so big and frightening, we have to have two words to show its dimension and scope, sort of. And then we'll talk a little bit about potential, maybe we'll discuss a little bit about civil defense, and then our Christian posture, your Christian posture, in regard to it. Recently, I was appointed to a core group on I guess it's sponsored really by the government. It's government money, of course, but the New York Academy of Sciences is running it. And it consists of a core group of, I think, about 12 scientists in the United States. And we're to assemble at Princeton, at the Nassau Inn, about five times over the next 2 years to discuss the long-term biomedical and psychosocial effects of nuclear war. And I have been sort of involved in this in a way. I haven't been either making bombs nor dropping them, but I have observed some tests. And my studies have been mainly directed at radiation effects. And I've spent since 1949 on this general subject. And in assembling for this first meeting at Princeton, I mean, many of us said, I mean, not again. Are we going to play the same old record all over again, you know? Because this has been discussed so very much before. And one of the scientists there, who held a very high position in government policy, is also a scientist, said that, well, it may seem trivial, but there are still many people today who believe that a nuclear war wouldn't be much different than World War II. There are others who believe that a nuclear war could destroy our civilization. And then there's quite a few others who believe that there's it's somewhere in between. And he felt that in the light of this, we should look at it. And we started out by reviewing the Hiroshima-Nagasaki incidents. And even our leaders, of course, have been disturbed in various ways by this. President Kennedy said that today every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculation or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us. So even in high places, they have some concern for this. Now, in preparation for this first meeting at Princeton, I reviewed again the available data on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and there's quite a bit of it. And of course, a lot of people can say, well, this is all a sort of a different dimension. But I noted a strange resemblance to the following writings on the Lamentations of Jeremiah as he described a very dark moment in the history of a people. And I'd like to read a few of these to you now in case some of you may not recall them. How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How is she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations and princesses among the provinces, how is she become tributary? She weepeth sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she hath none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They are become her enemies. From above hath he sent fire into my bones, and it prevailed against them. He has spread a net for my feet. He has turned me back. He has made me desolate and faint all the day. The tongue of the nursling cleaves to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The children beg for food, but no one gives to them. Those who feasted on dainties perish in the streets. Those who were brought up in purple lie on ash heaps. Now their visage is blacker than soot. They are not recognized in the streets. their skin has shriveled upon their bones. It has become as dry as wood. The Bible is a very contemporary book. It's remarkable for many reasons, not the least of which is that it relates to the significant events that are happening today in the life of all people, and it includes the critical dimensions and the significant facets, I think, of human relations. As I say, it's a very contemporary volume. Man seems to have a great penchant for things that go boom. I think this is no more manifest than as we survey what we are producing in largest quantity. And if your guest today is steel or cereal grains or chandeliers or bricks, building materials, you would be wrong, because we possess the largest inventory, probably the largest quantity, sort of ready for use in the form of explosives, obliterated forces. It now totals about 28,000 pounds of equivalent TNT for every man, woman, and child in the world. This is about 50 billion tons. Perhaps it is more significant to write it in pounds. Something like that. Of course, much of this is in our nuclear striking force. In using this, of course, we're making some estimates, and it's chiefly looking at the USSR and the U.S. supply. I must add that we are adding to this, because we're still producing plutonium in this country. There are still many reactors at Hanford Laboratories, where I used to work, producing plutonium. The Russians are still, no doubt, producing them. The Chinese, as some of you realize, I'm sure, are also producing this product, increasing their volume of production. And there are some others, I'm sure, that I'd like to get into the business. Among these are two unfriendly nations, the Arabs and the Israelites. I would predict that the Israelites may soon have it in some form or another. Yes? Yeah. This is the TNT equivalent. It's like 1 pound of TNT blowing up. I can't give it to you in any other dimension than that, but to say that the equivalent in explosive power on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was 20,000 pounds of TNT.
Has nothing to do with the weight of the bomb?
No. It's the weight of the TNT explosive. I think that's all I'll say on that. It's a pretty loud boom. I mean, even 20,000 is quite large. And of course, the projected attacks on the United States, say, are in dimensions several million times that of the Hiroshima Nagasaki incidents. I suppose. I wasn't here, but it makes a pretty good boom. Now, I might also add this very discomforting note that 80% of our income taxes go to pay the cost of past wars and prepare for future ones. Now, we can turn, I guess, somewhat to dimension. I've already mentioned some of our potential. For those of you who have not seen a nuclear detonation, it's a fantastically beautiful thing. You, of course, can't watch it go off because it would blind you if you're within quite a few miles. But what you do is you sort of brace yourself if you're within some several miles, and then you face the other direction or use very dark glass, and then after the shockwave goes by, then you turn around and watch it. And it is intense. It's a very, very beautiful. I guess the best analogy, it's sort of like sin. Sometimes very appealing, but it packs an imposing wallop, like death and destruction. Now, it's hard to talk about just what it can mean to the United States. I have a book here that some of you may wish to look at afterwards. When I was involved in consultation on civil defense and all, I was given this book from Technical Operations Incorporated. And they made a study on the probable fallout threat over the continental United States. And in this business, we have sort of mock exchanges, and you sort of pick your targets, and then you sort of look at what the effects of this would be, and you can find your hometown sort of on here, your general area, and you can look at the fallout pattern from it. Now, I must say that this is not so extensive, because these are rather small attacks, and they're mainly on military targets. But just because there are military targets doesn't mean that you in the city may not be involved, because the fallout pattern now on the very large devices, they go quite a ways, in like many miles. And when you look at a device and the detonation, you are looking at about, there are three things of concern, and that's the blast effect and the effect of heat, and then radiation. Now, in the Hiroshima and Nagasaki incidents, these were relatively small, and the blast effects and probably the heat did most of the damage. The radiation effects were, as far as causing deaths, acute deaths, or even subacute deaths, was really quite minimal. But with some of them, it's a little bit like putting a man here in a chair and maybe hitting him over the head with a sledgehammer at the same time, lighting him with gasoline and burning him, and then turning an X-ray machine on him. I mean, what killed him? It all three kill him, of course, if you're near him to the center. But on the blast effects, you get a pretty big hole if you're having a device that's on the ground, and you know about some of them out in the South Pacific, where you move quite a few tons of earth. And we'll get into this in a later lecture when I talk about something more attractive to me, and I hope to you, the peacetime uses of atomic energy. One of them being considered is to build canals, for example, to make a new Panama Canal. And we'll discuss that at another time. But the blast is very substantial. On the heat, of course, that's instantaneous, and we know some of the patterns from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the same would obtain, but at greater distances, where if you had a thin white dress on, you might be burned through. Well, no, it would reflect the heat, where if you had black patterns on it, maybe you'd be burned under that, because it's sort of an infrared range. And a lot of people, of course, the sheets of flesh, they were sort of like parboiled, but very superficially. And the heat is rather intense. With about a 5-megaton weapon, I think you could probably light a paper at 25 or 30 miles or something, if you have it up in the air. So we're talking about rather substantial things. Now, on the radiation effects, I wasn't going to mention this except to say, to give you an order of magnitude, and I'll show you these at another time. Now, when we talk about radiation, and we have certain units, like you use dollars in economics, and souls saved in your lecture. And we deal in R for Röntgen, or rads. We would say that's equivalent to rads, to rems, and so forth. Now, on looking at radiation sensitivity, I've listed there 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, 800 rads, sort of. And you will see that man sort of is somewhere between the goat and the pig. And that in a range of 400 or 500 rad is what would kill half the people. And if you get up to 1,000 rad, it will kill most all of the mammals, including the Norwegians. And so that gives you an order of magnitude. Now, when we're talking about the radiation effects from the kind of devices that may be delivered in a rather intense exchange, when you're getting up to 5 and 10 megaton weapons, you're talking about an intense fallout area initially here. Of the range of about 10,000 or upwards rad or R per hour at 2 hours. And of course, one would not last very long. It is fortunate, however, that this radiation falls by a factor of 10. Where you multiply the time times 7, and with every multiplication it goes down, as I recall, a tenth, so that would be 1,000 at, let's say this is 1 hour, huh? And to make it easy, so that's 7 hours, and then at 2 days, 49 hours roughly, it's down to 100, and then 2 weeks, it's down to 10 R per hour, and you could make some excursions in and out on this. So that's somewhat of the dimension that we're talking about. We'll talk about that. Now, what does it mean in populations? And a friend of mine, he found out I was interested in radiation. We were in graduate school together. He isn't through graduate school yet, because he always gets interested in overpopulation and thermonuclear war and stuff like that. So he sort of takes time off to learn all about this. And this is one of his charts. His name is Newell Mack. Father was on the staff at the University of Wisconsin and was our scientific advisor in Sweden for a while. But I think this expresses, can you see it back there, or generally see it? I haven't got my white background here yet, but this is percent survival in the United States. 100% survival, and that's where we start. And these are the megatons delivered in thousands. In other words, this is not 10 megatons, but 10,000 megatons. And by megaton, that's 1 million pounds equivalent of TNT. In Hiroshima, we had 20,000 pounds. It's a little less than this, really, but give and take a little here. But that's 20,000 pounds equivalent of TNT. Now, we're talking here. If it's 10 megaton, you see,
It's like this, see? So you can kind of get the order. That's 10 megaton, and then this is 10,000 megaton. You see, this, the kind of exchange we're talking about, if we really got into it, depending on what the objective, of course, of our opposition would be. We're thinking in terms at least of 5 to 10,000 megatons. Now, it's very significant as to when the exchange takes place and how, whether it's raining, whether they do a surface bursting or into the air. Some of them have advantages and disadvantages from a military standpoint, or whether they just select military targets, or do they take the cities too. Now, when one looks at the cities, the purple line falls very fast with fairly low megatonnage, because you can just pick out a few cities, I mean, 10 of them or so, and you can make a rather you can take 10 5 megaton bombs or something, and you can really polish off a lot of people. And so you can see that just with a rather small exchange, and perhaps as red lines go down steeper, you can kill about half the population. If you take only military targets, this is military and cities under a shelter situation. I'll get to that in a little while. Without shelter, and as you increase the megatonnage, you see I haven't reached zero here yet. Because some people over in Wyoming or somewhere, and other places, maybe southern North Dakota or northern North Dakota, or and some Norwegians. So that I think gives you the dimension. I just have a note here that says, well, out of 50,000 megatons, why do you have to go up so far? Well, that's probably a rough estimate of the U.S. stockpile. I think that's enough for that. It's really too much. But the potential of an exchange. We came very close, really, on at least one occasion. More than one occasion, I guess, but on the Cuba situation, it could have gone this way. I think it is remarkable, however, that we did, in a very critical time, avoid an exchange with Russia. And this critical time was when we did not have hard targets. In other words, the great advantage was those who would hit you first, because they had a pretty good idea where our supply was, and with a surprise attack, they could have compromised our ability to retaliate. The situation has now changed to an extent, in that we have some so-called hard targets. We have some other devices that are mobile, moved around, and we also have some in nuclear submarines and other type of equipment. And of course, we always have some upstairs and on alert. Of course, a lot depends on how fast we can get it off, but the advantage isn't completely to the one who strikes first now. We could still, even if we were hit first, we could inflict a great deal of damage upon those instructors. Now, I am not going into the subject of sort of anti-missiles, because most of this is classified, and I have not been in on the discussions of this in the very recent past. There, of course, is another dimension to this, and that is orbiting devices. Now, I don't know if anyone has any orbiting devices upstairs. There is a lot of stuff flying around upstairs that is in the classified category, both ours and other people's, surveillance type vehicles and so forth. Some of them are of advantage to us, perhaps, in that they're observing people who might be detonating things that might be coming our way. And there's, of course, a great advance in the technology in this area. The anti-missile thing is a very difficult area. And it's, as you know, there's much polemic surrounding it today as to, is this the way we should go? And of course, one of the devices is to probably detonate a nuclear device upstairs in the path of those coming in. And there are other devices that are being worked on that are quite fantastic. The thing I think that worries many people is that people other than England, France, United States, and Russia are now actively engaged in obtaining the potential for not only the production of the weapons, but their delivery. It wouldn't, China, for example, wouldn't be a great worry to us if they couldn't deliver them. If they produce them is one thing. When they get the potential, and they will have it in not too distant future, certainly within this decade, to deliver rather substantial quantities, perhaps it will be of far greater concern then. Now, another area that is of great interest to many people is that relating to civil defense. And you can get into more fights on this in your communities and in this nation than almost anything else. I recall when I was on a subcommittee of the National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council, when we were examining our posture relative to resources, because this is of great concern to us, because we as a nation, if we save the lives, we also have to be able to feed these people and clothe them and control disease. Our present posture is not very good in this area because of the distribution of, say, the supplies, and if transport is compromised, especially in the high population areas, say New England, the food supplies are very limited there. And if you have transportation compromised, even if you save the people from the initial attack, what are you going to do with it? So there will be mass starvation, disease, and this is of great concern. Now, in our activities, we were concerned with resource assessment. And we, in certain mock exchanges, we would look at, well, where are the resources now? And we were looking especially at animal resources, because if you remove animal resources, you are removing a rather substantial component of our economy and certainly our food supply. Can you eat a cow, for example, that is radiated heavily? Well, you can. We ate dead horses when we were moving as prisoners and so forth out of Poland. And I'm still here. Just that I look 65 and I'm only 39 or a few years older. I mean, that's nothing to do with it. But this is what we were looking at. And I was very impressed with this because, as part of our orientation, we were taken to a large hole in the ground in a secret place in the east. And this was the seat of our government. This is where we played the war games. And this would be the headquarters then a foreign nation at that time, in the case of a nuclear exchange. And I think they wish it probably deeper now, but that was some years ago. But after spending the day there, and it was a rather fantastic place, and coming out into the open again, and then we'd been discussing civil defense, you know, and I couldn't help but think that we'd sort of made the circuit, you know. Many years ago, our forefathers started out underground in the caves, and we sort of made the full circuit, and now we're thinking about going back in. Now, I think that I had something to say here about, yes, Sir Winston Churchill said something to say about this on civil defense and this general subject. A curious paradox has emerged. Let me put it simply. After a certain point has been passed, it may be said, the worse things get, the better. The broad effect of the latest developments is to spread almost indefinitely, and at least a vast extent, the area of mortal damage. Then it may be well that we shall, by a process of sublime irony, have reached a stage in this story where safety will be the sturdy child of terror and survival the twin brother of annihilation. There are many people in government today who believe that we should not spend the $5 billion or the $20 billion or the upward estimate, probably in this case of upwards maybe of $80 billion, to really secure our industries and a large number of our population to save them in the case of a rather intense nuclear exchange. It would take a good deal of money to do this, to make sort of a situation where you could have a substantial number of the people survive an intense exchange. However, I believe there's a more moderate course that should be considered, and many people have proposed it, that when we do build federal buildings or schools, this is a good place to sort of start deeper in the ground. This may be a good supply place to put some of our very now dwindling surplus food, and also other medicines and this type of thing. And have it, say, in the cafeteria underground for many of these schools. Now, there have been a few of these built on a trial basis, and they are not that costly, because from the standpoint of heating and cooling, they have some real advantages, and the students have taken quite well to them. I think down in Mexico, or New Mexico, I think it is, they have utilized these to good effect. So if we go to these, there are certain many areas in the fallout pattern. If the detonation is here and the fallout pattern is here, that the sort of a moderate shelter would protect many people. But there's also another reason for this, and a good one, because we do have other crises that do occur where we are not able to take care of the affected population, where these could serve in that way. So I would commend that to you for consideration. Now, in the few minutes that's left, I thought it would be well to see... maybe a look at our posture in this regard. I have not entered into some of the real unfortunate aspects of this because I want you to sleep well tonight, or I don't want to disturb your sleep too much for no good reason. That is, just to have you worry. I am now looking at something by Sylvester Thiessen, who's a
Catholic theologian, and he has written an interesting article on man and nuclear weapons. And he quotes from Pope John the 13th as follows: "For if we are brothers in name and in fact, if we are made partners of a common destiny in this life and in the next, why, we say, are we capable of acting as opponents, private enemies of others? Why envy others, stir up hate against them, prepare death-dealing weapons against them? Already there has been enough strife among men. Already far too many thousands of young men in the flower of their age have poured out their blood. Let all then direct their energies not at the things which cause men to keep separate from each other, but rather at those by which they can be united in a fair and mutual esteem for their respective goods and interests." But man is hard to change, you know. I told a couple of you the other night, and I'm reminded of it again as we were reviewing the Hiroshima incident. They had collected up many of the bodies. Some of them were still breathing, and they sort of separated them out, and they had the whole hospital just lined with these bodies that were still alive, and some of them were still conscious. And I suppose it was within the first 2 days, and suddenly a person appeared in this hospital and announced that the Japanese too had developed this secret weapon and had just dropped it on San Francisco and had killed many people. And these people who were almost, they were half dead, rose up and cheered. Now, some people choose the path of nuclear pacifism, and that is certainly a possibility. Some speak of these people as hopelessly naive, or they do not just know the facts of life. And they say you can't just unilaterally disarm. To this, the pacifist, who has often even been charged with being masochistic, that, and here's what I'm going to quote from one of them here now. I think if I can find it. This is from Gordon Zahn, War and Conscience. "Their acceptance of martyrdom as a probable consequence of consistent Christian pacifism does not imply a necessarily defeatist attitude or the brand of quietism that counsels one to sit quietly and wait for the blow to fall. The Christian pacifist is not masochistic. He seeks no unnecessary martyrdom. Every legitimate human means falling between the extremes of immoral compromise on the one hand and immoral resistance on the other may and should be employed to avert or reduce the threat." You see, I'll depart here a moment. You see, what concerns so many people, you see, in this thinking is this, that we have two unfortunate choices: either a mass destruction, even the compromise of civilization on the one hand, or communist tyranny on the other. And this is what I think he's directing his remarks to. And these human means failing, the purgation he realistically foresees need not keep from the pacifist's lips the prayer that, if it be God's will, the bitter cup be spared him. But his dread of personal suffering and the loss of civilization, admittedly more amenable to Christianity, than would be a communist civilization would never permit him to unleash mass destruction. In other words, if the choice were there, he says, mass destruction is not the route to take. If innocents must die to purge the world of sin, and Christian history and tradition shows that to be the case, it is far more consistent that Christians should be on the dying than on the killing end. Christians, of course, find it difficult to harmonize the spirit of war with the spirit of what Jesus lived and taught regarding self-sacrificing love. C. Wright Mills had some angry words to say about this subject in his pagan sermons to Christians, and I think it also appeared in the book The Cause of World War III. Religion has become a religiously ineffective part of the show that fills up certain time slots in weekly routine of cheerful robots. To ministers of God, we must now say, if you accept the entertainment terms of success, you cannot succeed. The very means of your success make for you failure as witnesses. If you do not specify and confront real issues, what you say will surely obscure them. If you do not alarm anyone morally, you will remain morally asleep. If you do not embody controversy, what you say will inevitably be an acceptance of the drift to the coming human hell. Who among you is considering what it means for Christians to kill men and women and children in ever more efficient and impersonal ways? Who among you uses his religious imagination to envision another kind of basis for policies governing how men should treat one another? If you are not today concerned with this, the moral condition of those in your spiritual care, then, gentlemen, what is your concern? As pagans who are waiting for your answer, we merely say, you claim to be Christians, and we ask, what does that mean as a biographical and as a public fact? I think in reply, that we can honestly say that many Christians are concerned. And I don't have an answer for you, any pat answers, because I don't think there are any here. But I think we must examine ourselves, and I will do this in some later lectures as we face and discuss the subject of death, which Walt has already touched on here. The prospect of a nuclear war is certainly the most frightening confrontation of people and their products today, certainly. And as one examines it, for those who do not have the faith that Beth talked about today and that Ross discussed and that others failed to mention in the discussion that Beth mentioned, I think have some long nights ahead of them if they contemplate the possibilities. We can turn to Paul too and recall what he says about this, that the sufferings of the present time are nothing to be compared with the glories that are to be revealed. That's one. Some of you may say, well, that's sort of an escape. Jeremiah, in his Lamentations, also had something to say about it. In the part of the same chapter that I read to you earlier, he said that the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him.
And now you probably realize why I might have read, or why I did read to you, "The darkness knows neither light nor itself. Only the light knows itself, and the darkness also. None but God hates evil and understands it." And until a man has love, and I think we can also have faith, it is well that he should have fear. So long as there are wild beasts about, it is better to be afraid than to be secure. I am available for discussion on this subject now as we close. Yes, you want to...
No, I don't have a question for you, but I have a question for the rest of these people. Why in the world did Paul? All the meaning of things, what was so wonderful about what he said?
I would say it's the way he said it. Was explained it.
Pardon?
I would say it's the way he said it and explained it.
I got a lot out of that myself.
That's what I thought.
You mean a nice performance?
No.
I mean, they all put on it.
We were enlightened a bit.
Pardon?
We were somewhat enlightened of this difficult subject of nuclear war. And there is still hope. And that is the source of... it's good to hear that from a scientist. And he should know. We're living under the threat of this bomb exploding on us any day. And here comes someone who says, well, there's still hope.
Well, I got the impression that it was less hopeful than ever.
Not when I saw that bomb explode in the Pacific, I didn't think there was any hope. Particularly the ones that they're banning today, I still believe. When they talk about kill and overkill, and so on and so forth. And this is constantly hanging like a black cloud over my head.
Right, now, one thing you learned this morning was that we have in our possession, per person, more than was used in Hiroshima. Well, that makes me want to...
Right.
Well, I don't know what cry or I don't know what there's to talk about here. And then when you think of the Bay of Pigs, I know pigs get back into this all the time.
I'm sorry about that.
when you think of what a blundering bunch of stupid fools we're controlling, think what an ill-considered, ill-planned, ill-executed thing.
He reinforced my belief that what Luther said, if the world should come to an end tomorrow, I'll still plant a tree tonight. I'm not going to worry about that bomb, and because I have this belief, I'm going to continue on working. What's the use of working if we're going to live under the fear of this thing exploding any minute? In a way, he encouraged me to go on and keep working and sort of reinforce the faith that I already had in God and Christ. And when I hear that, I feel like laughing for joy.
Two questions, though, Cain. Point one is, at what point is it possible that somebody will say, well, since we already have enough stockpile to kill everybody in the world, it's stupid to keep on doing more? I mean, we could use some of the money for other things, if nothing else. And then the second thing is, the only hope for security, two guys are pointing a gun, one each at the other, and they know that if one shoots, the other will shoot before the bullet reaches him, and both will die. And this is our only slender thread of hope, apparently, in this present situation. Those are two things I want you to comment on, because there are two things that I heard as basic.
Yes. There, of course, have been many suggestions in regard to what we should do with this money that we are spending? I mean, why go to more than the point Howie brought up on where have I got it? I mean, this 28,000 pounds per person. Why do we need more? You know, that's a very good question. Well, part of the answer may come up when I discuss the peacetime use of nuclear energy, because we can in fact turn those weapons, those swords, into plowshares, because the plutonium that is being produced, which is the chief component of our bombs, can be utilized in power reactors. The technology in fact is being worked on in this state. There are leaders along the Southern Britain at the utilization of plutonium for peacetime use. You can say, well, we can maybe utilize this then for this. The other suggestion, and one of them is made by Linus Pauling, who said that, well, instead of doing all this, let us say make a Department of Peace in the government, and let us then give them an unlimited budget, or say $10 billion a year, which is pretty substantial, and let them do research and give sort of no limit on many of the things that they can come up with to somehow curb the armaments race and to help out to peoples that would prevent this kind of exchange, which is so frightening. I think in partial answer to how as far as it's concerned, his real concern is in the way that he's very disturbed by this information. We can sort of go to Winston Churchill, but look at another dimension which I could discuss on, but I don't think I'm really quite prepared for this week, but I can discuss it on other occasions. And that's in the subject of chemical and biological warfare. This is a far more practical and cheaper approach to compromising a nation. And I think that we now have the technology that could in fact handle it. I mean, if I were a country wanting to take America, it would be far better to use something where it didn't have wasn't totally destroyed, nor have the residual of radioactivity. But we haven't used this. The Russians are really were for a while, I think, ahead of us in this subject. Now, we did kill a lot of people with gas in World War I. I don't know how many of you realize how many, but probably we had an excess of 1 million casualties in gas.
My word was used in World War II, it did such a good job.
We killed all the gas masks.
Yeah, we killed the troops who were using them. About the indiscriminately.
Well, why wasn't this nuclear?
Do the same with all out and wind direction and so on and so forth. It seems to be alive in the same vein.
Yes.
If man has sense enough to do something, he cannot control too
well. Well, I think though part of it is that we don't have well, what I'm saying, I think, is that we hope that some of this, this thinking that has prevented us from using this, may prevent
this
an intense exchange. I'm quite sure that there will probably be some mild exchanges. I will be very surprised if there wouldn't be mild exchanges. I think if Nasser would have had one in the pocket, he might have used it on Tel Aviv. I'd be interested in your reaction to this, but he didn't. Unfortunately, the Russians hadn't given it. Now, the reason that he didn't bomb Tel Aviv, because he did have a few planes left, of course, but, I mean, they were afraid what would happen to them. I mean, Nasser didn't want to lose Aswan Dam, he didn't want Cairo bombed, and he didn't want the Nile contaminated with radioactivity, which is what the Israelites were going to do to him, and they knew it. And so this sort of Democles, I mean, sort of works both ways. And it would be nice to have this spring on it, a little more sturdy. And it's this strength of this string that I think concerns to always
strong.
What do you think God's rule would be? That we have to defend ourselves and maintain this balance, or go ahead and unilaterally disarm and sacrifice ourselves? Would you be the pastor?
There are a number of conditions which all must be satisfied in order to be morally justifiable. They can be reduced to seven. The cause must be just. The war must be made by a lawful authority. The intention of the government declaring war must be just. War must be the only possible means of securing justice. Only right means may be employed in the conduct of war. There must be a reasonable hope of victory. The good probability to be achieved by victory must outweigh the probable evil effects of war. And of course, this came up for our discussion.
As it always does, was the decision correct of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Were the lives lost going that way be less, the destruction less, than going the way we were going? As you know, the commitment of troops planned and the defense that Japan had planned would have been a very terrifying thing to consider. I think there are many in Japan who feel that the cost in human life and in property was less than this was taken. I have in my possession here, for some of you who did not read it, if you were interested in this, Henry Stimson's essentially defense of why he made the